You're listening to the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirk Wood Bromley.
All right, so this episode of the Inverse Theater Podcast features an interview with Joshua Spafford. Josh is an actor I met in 1996, I guess it is, or seven. As of today, Saturday, April 22nd, 2023, I am still working with him. So in a sense, he is my longest collaborator. He's directed quite a few of my plays and is an actor who's been in many of them. He is a powerhouse, as anyone who's seen him knows. He entered my life through just a random audition down at NADA, and ever since then I've been handing him major parts and letting him direct my plays. And his love of the theater and his intelligence about the theatrical process is really quite unparalleled. He just really lives and breathes the stuff. He and I have had many crazy adventures together, both in the theater and out of the theater, which maybe someday will come to light. But I love him dearly, and it's awesome speaking with him. So here he is, Joshua Spafford. All right, I have Josh on the line, right? Are you there, Josh?
I am here 100%. Hi.
Great. Hey, Josh. Good to hear you talk to you. Yeah. You and I talk practically every day, so it's true. It's a little weird in this professional setting, but let's try not to be too professional. So awesome. Thank you for sitting down with me and talking with me. I'm super excited to hear from you because there's obviously a lot of story there. What I've been doing with these sort of major actors I've worked with is mostly reminiscing. Of course, other things can occur in the midst of reminiscing, but by and large, we've kind of been going backward and just talking about the beginning and then the middle and the end and what happened and what you did and what it was like. And so that's kind of what I want to do with you. So I guess I'm going to start by kind of asking you the standard initial question, which is, how did you first come across, I guess for you, it would be Bromley? Because Inverse hadn't started then. How did you first come across Bromley, and what was your very first experience?
Yeah, wow. It was an incredibly pivotal moment in my life. Even though I was relatively young, in my mid-20s, I had just left the Philippines, where I had a pretty healthy career on stage, on screen, on film. I had felt creatively stifled there. And that's a whole other story, but I took a wild risk in leaving some security and certainty of career. I had a good, if you will. I was on soap operas. I was in the national leading repertory company for many years, and I could have coasted happily there for a long time. But at any rate, I chose not to. And I went to New York almost on a whim. I'd been there a couple of years earlier, in 95. I had done a play with a group called The Shakespeare Project, which did sort of Shakespeare in various parks throughout the city to help all sorts of demographics, with a bunch of people I met in London at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And I had such a positive experience doing theater in New York for that one summer, being independent, and certainly it was definitely an off-Broadway thing. So it was very much sort of like outsider art or very guerrilla theater-minded. And I had such a rise out of that experience that when I went back to the Philippines to a very structured theater culture, I missed it, and it really opened my mind. So in 97, I moved to New York on a whim, and I did a play at the Vineyard Theater, my first play, and it was wonderful. And I remember I had gotten cast in some kind of regional theater, this production of Midsummer Night's Dream, in a very like status quo standard regional theater type thing. And for me, having just moved from the Philippines, this was great. This is a big deal. But also at the same time, I was like, I just got out of that. I just got out of this very relatively predictable structure where we would basically do the same kind of material. Western classics, Broadway fare, maybe some popular Shakespeare at most. And I had left that to explore new things. So while I had been cast in that, and I think rehearsals were about to start in 2 weeks, I saw an ad in, I believe it was the Village Voice, on a whim. And when I got to New York, I thought, like, wow, I want to read the Village Voice. Like, I was yeah, exotic. Like, I'm going to be an actor, even though I had left a fruitful acting career. You know, I was in covers of magazines and had TV shows. And, like, I had left all that behind, but I thought there was some authenticity and grit and excitement in going to New York and working from the bottom, so to speak.
Yes. Little did you know.
Little did I know how right that was. And here's the thing, and seeing how I might fare with New York-based actors who, in my mind, were like New York theater actors with the best in the world. So I saw this ad in Backstage, and having had a casted job in a regional theater, so I had that safety net, and it mentioned Love's Labor's Lost or a sequel or something like that, and it said to go to this audition. And I had barely been in New York 11 or 12 days. And I'm sorry, I'd barely. So I go down to this audition, and I'd never been south of 14th Street at this point. And I go down to the Lower East Side, and it's Ludlow Street on a super early morning when everything was closed. So you see sort of trucks loading meats, and you see movers, and you see drunks stumbling out of bars from the night before. You see garbage, and I was thrilled. I thought, "Wow, this is bizarre." And yeah. I go down a basement access chute.
Yeah, that's right.
Not the doors.
That's right. That's
to
right.
to the basement. Of a place called the Pink Pony, which, as you probably know, I believe was like a cafe, restaurant, bar, and performance space, right?
It was a cafe, performance space, right across the street from Nada, the theater.
Yeah,
yeah.
And in a room that was, I don't know, 15 by 20, I meet this charming, wily, slender, bright-eyed man with a Robin Hood cap and a feather in the cap named Aaron Bell, Beale. And he was there, and, "Hey, Josh, great to meet you." And he shook my hand warmly, and he smiled in my eyes. He's like, "Okay, what do you got for me?" And I'd had a professional career playing stages, audiences of, I don't know, 1,000 people. So I pull out some Henry V meant to be performed in front of maybe 500 or 1,000 people at full voice. And we were in this tiny room. I didn't know any better. I hadn't done any better. I had just done these full-scale Shakespearean productions. But I thought, fuck it, let's do it. So yeah. I turned my intention and volume and emotions to tilt. and I do it.
Yeah.
And he sits there and he nods and he shakes my hand and he's warm and lovely and I crawl out of the basement. And it was the next day that I got a phone call on voicemail, on a voicemail machine at a place at a friend's I was staying at. And it was someone working for him saying, "Hey, we loved your audition and we're doing this play. And it's a remake of Romeo and Juliet in verse by this guy, this poet, Kirkwood Bromley. And there's a role that we want to see you for." And I'm like, okay. So there was no mention of Love's Labor's Lost at all. That's what I had gone in for. So, yeah. So it was interesting. It was interesting. So I was fascinated and curious and a little frightened. So I went to this new audition. And this is really where it began. I went to another basement type theater.
Yeah.
And I walked into a busy...
I think you came right into Nada at that point, I think, right?
I came into Nada. And and it was a modest, what do you call it, underground storefront theater? I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Basement storefront theater.
Yeah. And so,
kind of a half basement. I mean,
yeah,
I would say, right? You went down maybe 3-4 steps.
Yep. And I walked in, I sat down, I was given some sides. And there were auditions in progress, and I read the sides, and having already been passionately in the classical theater vein, but also at the same time being hungry to explore new avenues, I immediately recognized that this was something special. Just sitting there in the audience, watching people audition, reading the side. And I was given a side for this character named Primalo right then and there on the spot. So I perused it and I just had a handle. I had a handle. I had a sense of what the playwright, you, were doing.
Yeah.
At least in my mind.
Yeah.
And I got up and I dug in with my training, even though I was young. I was 24 and I dug in there and I made a wide stance and I decided to play it direct and still. And I did that. And while I was doing that, I veer over. And while I'm performing this chunk of text, and I remember the text very well, I see a very handsome man, strikingly handsome, sitting there with a small group of actors, including young and attractive actresses sitting around him. And I think, oh, that must be the lead actor sitting there. But he's whispering. He's whispering asides. It's like, nodding his head. And I'm like, this. Who is this guy? How, you know, is he interrupting my performance? Who is this man? And I finished the little monologue, and Aaron's there nodding and warm and gratuitous. And you look at me and you nod and you clap a few quiet claps. And everyone's sort of coming up to you and whispering and nodding. And I realize this is not an actor. This is someone else. And in the moment, I realize that this is the rock star. This is Kirkwood Bromley. So that was, and in the same moment, I met some other lovely people at the same time. I met Jenny Avert and Jenny Hannigan, and I was like, I'm 24, and I'm like, I'm ready to rock and roll, and I'm like, hey, I want to audition. Is it cool if in this scene I kiss you? There was no intimacy directors then. And she goes, do it.
It was the Wild West. That's so right.
It was the Wild West, and I felt emboldened because I already had a sense that this was downtown New York theater. I understood who came out of here. I understood its legacy, its myth, its energy, its prodigy. I got that. I knew all of that.
Yeah.
And I had left a safe thing because I wanted to be seen more than the box that I was in, which at the time was like a young ingenue actor. To really spread my wings and independent of the of the roles and box I've been put in. So to me, I was doing this secret thing. Like I was going and going to gritty downtown New York for little or no pay, which is all absurd given the career I come from. So yeah. That little taste, and everyone in that room was so religious in their commitment to creating abstract or neoclassical or alternative art. Yeah. And that was my sense. I probably couldn't have articulated it then, but I sensed that. And I sensed a camaraderie with people in that room on that first day. And even that first day, I went, oh, yeah, there are some people who've not even done this. Maybe the kid down the street is a first-time actor. And this other guy next to me, he's a Juilliard graduate. It didn't matter. It was a wide spectrum. I didn't feel alone. I was like, okay, I'm an Amerasian kid. I'm a gypsy. I cover multiple cultures, but I'm not alone in that. I like a moth to a flame. I'm not the only one attracted to another way of expressing theater.
Yeah.
Besides the normal way. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. That's a really great story. Tell me, since everybody's kind of very, I would say, and from my experience, like their first time is their best time, you know, when it comes to like being handed some Bromley to perform, and the kind of the wowie zowie effect of like, what is this?
Yeah.
I talked to Hank last week, and he was kind of like, you know, I think he had a similar sort of English theater education to you. I think he was at RADA, maybe. I don't know.
Lambda, but yeah, they're sister schools.
Lambda, exactly. And
or Central, he said that one of them. Yeah,
he said that when he Central, that's what it was. And so he said, like, when he was handed the script, he was just, it's like his little like Shakespeare feelers went off or something, or like there was a weird recognition of something that he had studied and was familiar with and good at, but yet then there was also this kind of like, wait, this is weird and different. Talk about, like, you know, not just the what was on the page, but like, you know, what did you have a similar experience?
You bet. I thought about this recently, because every time, starting with the first time, I would be given a new Bromley script. It was like Christmas morning. It was such a fucking thrill for the storyteller, theater maker, and actor in me, but none so much as the first time. Because maybe like Hank, or as you say, someone who wanted to create theater in a poetically realistic, heightened way. You know, I'd done some Yeats theater, Shakespeare, I'd done Sophocles. But the goal then, as a young actor and as a director, was always breaking your back to withdraw or reveal through the dense poetry, but also through the ages, humanity, relevance, poetry, and meaning.
Mm.
Now, if you're breaking your back to milk that cow through Shakespeare's or whatever, and yet here was someone who did that through a modern lens, it shattered my mind, and obviously other minds too. So without taking away from the complexity of thought or the complexity of syntax or the complexity of themes, thematically and relevance were related to the world we live in, and there were these clues of something vital and not precious. And that was the main thing. Like, oh, we can be holy and profane at the same fucking time. We can make relevant theater and messy theater. We can play cello and electric guitar.
Yeah.
And as someone who wants to be freely expressive. I got that sense. I won't pretend to have understood the script on day one or through the years. Yeah. It took me a while, but I'm like, oh, this is like, these are real. This is music. These scripts are music that a trained performer can do. And sometimes you're playing classical, and sometimes you're rock and roll, and sometimes you're punk. And that's where I can most fully express myself. And so that first script, and mind you, I got lucky. I got a profoundly beautiful lead role the first time out, was a gift. And set my commitments to this work.
That I really appreciate that point. I think that really nails it on the head, because I will say, like, you know, as the person who wrote that play and several plays before that, it was definitely my mantra in the 90s, and as I was starting out to kind of learn how to playwright, that my enemy was the closet drama. And honestly, my enemy was Yeats and Eliot. And verse theater that was precious. Verse theater that was sort of like poetry to be staged. And, you know, the reason, and I knew in my heart, the reason people continue to love Shakespeare is that he gives you all the poetry you could ever want, and everything we ascribe to poetry. It's elegance, it's sublimity, it's metaphysics, it's musicality, it's, in a sense, it's dedication to beauty and the gods and truth and the higher principles of humanity. It makes us feel like we're walking in this kind of pure moral space, way above the dregs of the earth. But it does that, but at the same time, it is as physical and dirty and alive and breathy and gritty as life itself. And that was my template, and that's what I wanted to do. So I'm glad you saw that. Thank you for noticing that. And I think that, you know, I think to speak a little beyond just me, I think that is one of the, what I would call, trademarks of what makes a great verse play. Aaron Bell, who you spoke of, used to say, oh, we should drop the V word, get rid of verse. Because when people hear verse, you know, they think stuffy. And, you know, that's probably true. But, I was aware of the dangers of stuffy, and I really worked not to do that. That's right. You scored the role of Primallo, it was your, as we'll talk about a little more, you went on to play many lead roles, and Primallo is, as much the lead of Icarus and Aria as anyone is. I would kind of say that you've got, obviously got Icarus and Aria, but on Aria's side, you've got Jimmy Jones, and on Icarus's side, you've got Primallo. And those are, in a sense, kind of these other, almost more fascinating protagonists and antagonists. Primallo is the reason the play happens, actually, I would say, because, you know, they Jimmy Jones probably would have resisted his 16-year-old daughter or whatever, hanging out with his 20-year-old quarterback. But Primallo's complicated approach to Icarus and his past and everything makes the play happen. So you became Primallo. And you, being the person who was sitting in the seats when you auditioned, it was, you were head and shoulders above the competition. The minute you read Primallo, we were like, okay, well, at least we found Primallo. You know, I don't know if you remember, in those days, we used to talk about how you wore cologne.
I do to this day. I was, if I may, I thought about your ex-wife recently, lovely Jen, and she took me aside one day and said, so this cologne thing, you wear a different cent for each role. And I thought I was, you know, Daniel fucking Day-Lewis, because I thought of this thing. I'm like, yeah, I change it for each role, but I wore a special scent to come and ensnare you all.
And well, it worked.
And guess what? I still do it.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Actors take note, because, you know, it really, you got the role just, you know, on your stature and your skill. But I do remember the cologne, and it was like, it was a kind of like, you know, wow, I've never really smelled an actor too, you know? And so it was really like you know, 2D became 3D. So it was really, Josh was multidimensional, you know, all my senses were alive. And,
I just want a tangent. I want a tangent because to get spiritual or karmic or I'm going to lean into that for a moment. That role at my age, I hadn't turned 25. I was literally 24, probably Primalo's age. And I had hippie parents. My mother came from an affluent family, and she rejected that in the Philippines and went on to, like, hitchhike and sing in folk bands in the States. And she met a British sailor, and they built a boat, and we sailed around the world. That could only be a product of the, you know, 70s. And in those travels as a kid, I went to many Latino countries, like Colombia and Mexico and Spain and...
Yeah.
And when you sail somewhere, you sail to the docks. And the docks are a colorful place full of hustlers and charmers and criminals and also international sailors. And I met 1,000 primalos, you know, full of the need to survive. Perhaps they were drug dealers. Perhaps they were not. Charming people, striving people, and knowing all the and people who spoke with a challenged English, but were quite articulate in their own language. That background combined with my own ambition as a young actor in New York City, that melded perfectly into this beautiful role, and. Whether it's talent, skill, or luck, that role changed my life. And it's literally in my blood. I can recite almost the whole play by heart. And even reading the lines now, I have so much sort of a Pavlovian or muscle memory that just speaking the lines induce raw emotion in me. And... that's a gift, regardless of all the highs and lows you and I as collaborators and friends have worked with over the year. That alone would have been enough. And it really paid off, leaving a safe and secure thing, and I'm really grateful for that. So
yeah, great.
Anyways,
great.
Let's keep going.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I mean, you were obviously anybody who saw it, you were obviously legendary, and you know, you were the biggest man on stage, and the tumultuous epicenter of the play, and people, you know, who saw you do it just felt like they were in the presence of a great star playing a great role that just changed. Just changed everything. I mean, you know, changed. Changed the idea of what. I mean, I say it. You know, I mean, I know I'm the playwright, but I, you know, it kind of. I don't think there'd been a role like that in American theater ever. You know, its breadth and its height and its. You know, multilingualism and the flow and the torture and the status that he has and the complicated spirit and the role he plays in the play. It was his name and, you know, just him and you know, his recognizability in American culture.
Yeah.
the mystique of this, you know, borderlands drug dealer, and
yeah.
You know, it's just dripping with reference for people, and it was a big deal. It was pretty amazing, yeah. And and it's obviously started our relationship, which proceeded to take many forms. You became, I was saying to Mick O'Brien the other day that kind of he was my sort of leading man for my crazy, weird avant-garde plays, my last like five plays.
Okay.
He was kind of my Josh Spafford. You'd left the city, you moved out, I don't know if you'd even do those plays anyhow, but he was kind of, you for my early phase, for my Shakespearean phase, for lack of a better phrase, became the leading man. And you know, that didn't always, that didn't always mean like you played an Andrus or what's the lead guy in Midnight Brainwash Revival? Kieran, Kieran, or you know, you were always you played some clowns, definitely played some clowns. You did play the lead in Griffin Hunter. You were the title role in Griffin Hunter.
Engine parts, part of the engine.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, they were huge parts. We always knew that, you know, Josh is gonna take any role we give him and make it an amazing spectacle, and that's something I think needs to be said before we move on to the next play. Is like, you know, I think you played a lot of different types of roles. Because, like, for instance, the next play we did, after Icarus and Aria, which, you know, played at the Fringe Festival, played at NADA, never played at NADA, played at House of Candles. The next play we did finally get you to your Love's Labor's Lost. Do you remember this experience?
I have so much love for this play. I feel like it's not talked about. Or not celebrated enough, and I still love it, and I still have hopes to produce it or direct it in some capacity. So you have a play that I know called Lights, Losses, Loved, and that was the play I came for.
Yeah.
And I remember some chat you and I had in the early years when we were getting to know each other, just talking about our affection for Love's Labor's Lost.
Yeah, you know, let me point out really quick. That's really interesting because the thing that Aaron Bell and I bonded over was that I sent him a copy of a play of mine, Once Unwished Work, where I said to him, I see this as kind of a spin-off of Love's Labor's Lost. And we had coffee and we both like looked across the table at each other and we were like, Love's Labor's Lost is one of the greatest plays ever written.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's not, you know, that's often not recognized, and then I remember you showed up and we would talk and I realized you saw that. You understood what Love's Labor's Lost is in Shakespeare's canon. So go ahead.
Yeah, no, exactly. I love this play. I even at that young age, I'd done a lot of the heavy duty. I'd done the Macbeths. I'd done Bloody Othello, way too young, all like the hits. But in my heart, I love this tender little piece called Love's Labor's Lost by Shakespeare that, you know, is known to be one of his younger plays. But I and probably other people saw a lot of beauty, poetry, and heartbreak and angst that like a young person, a young man, perhaps you and I could relate to. And I loved and love that play. So you got to doing that. It was the next play, and so incredibly different than this heady, intense, neo Shakespearean drama where you spilled your guts out every night, and it was this delightful thing with obviously a lot of light, but lots of shadows too, if you explore them. And one night after coffee, you and I sat down and agreed that Love's Labor's Lost, when performed beautifully, was like champagne, right? It was fizzy and sparkly, and it's a young person's play. And I saw that in your play.
Yeah.
Fuck, I love that play. Either I imagined this or you did it. But this is, you know, a quarter of a century ago. Yeah. But I feel like you mirrored the rhythm or the scansion of Love's Labor's Lost into your play. I feel like you mirrored the meter. Am I inventing that?
No, I mean, it would take a lot of class time to get, all the connections between Love's Labor's Lost and Life's Lost is Loved are vast and many. Okay. They're in the phrases, they're in the rhythms, they're in the characters, they're mirrors of each other, but they're supposed to be sequels 400 years later, blah, blah, blah. There's definitely a lot there. And I mean, I know that, you know, in a sense, I never really occurred to me, but, you know, I think you played Primalo, and I think we decided to cast you as Don Armato.
Yeah.
Don Armato DiMaggio, but in my version, which was Dada Mysterio DiMistico. And so I think we kind of took Primalo and we like turned him into like, you know,
to a clown. We went into a clown.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The goof, the clown. And it was, and you played next to Matt Mayer, who played Slack, and you were Don Armato, and I guess who's the Love's Labor's Lost character? Mott? Is it Mott? Yeah, Mott.
Mott. So Matt and I did Don Armato and Mott, and then Dada Mysterio and Slack.
So that's right.
Doubling. Yeah.
That's right. So tell us what was your experience with that play like? That one was at NADA, so you actually hadn't performed at NADA. So
no,
with this you played at NADA.
We played at NADA, which it lacked the glamour and the energy and the wow factor of Icarus and Aria, which kind of had some buzz.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing. Like, you have to remember with Icarus and Aria, it was like directed by... it was directed by Aaron, who that very year with John and Nancy Clancy started the New York Fringe Festival. John Clancy and Elena Holy started the Fringe Festival. So, you know, we got a pretty nice headlining spot in the very first New York Fringe Festival. And we played at New Eurekan Poets Cafe, which is a beautiful space and has tons of history. And then we played at the House of Candles, which was a huge, beautiful space, you know, lofty and big and, you know, and we had a lot of buzz. We won awards, the lines around the block, blah, blah, blah. And so now we go and we do a play in NADA.
Right. And so that was different. Right. And I started to meet more creatives, actors that I hadn't met in this Icarus and Aria cast. So people like Hank, people like Bob,
These
lovely, talented guys who bring a different kind of energy and a different kind of skill. And, you know, Hank and I had a similar background in that we had had some training in England, but we played different kinds of roles.
Yeah.
And I think about Hank a lot because he always feels like the other side of the coin to me, you know, like we've had a similar experience, but we play different roles and a different kinds of people, but we have in some ways trod in a similar path in that we have dedicated a lot of time and energy to your work with our similar background. So he was in this and a bunch of other people. There may have been two casts. I don't know. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Yeah. I think there were. Yeah. There were two casts. Yeah.
And it was in this little modestly sized basement theater. And like, again, I had come from commercial theater. I had come from doing Neil Simon plays or Les Miserables, you know, for 1,000 people or 2,000 people. So now I'm doing this play with maybe in a basement with this unique playwright for maybe 15 or 20 people, And it was 3 hours long.
Yep.
And I loved it. And it was beautiful. And it really tested my commitment to exploring a new vein of theater making with or without a commercial audience. And
I feel like I was, you know, obviously one could have seen that as like a deflating thing, but I think I was able to hold your interest because I think, you know, you if you knew Love's Labor's Lost and you're doing this play and, you know, you could see that the writer was onto something, that he was exploring a Shakespeare play in a way that was, you know, that had some robustness to it. But we should admit that, you know, that play was the death of Nada, and that play had I think a couple directors, because we lost Aaron. Do you remember that?
I do remember very well. I remember a lot of things about that.
We lost Aaron because Aaron's empire was crumbling. There was the crazy guy who lived upstairs who would come down and threaten to shoot everybody. Aaron's girlfriend at the time, Kirsten Ames, ended up directing. I think the cast ended up kind of directing. It was a struggling ship.
Yeah, that was a real eye opener for someone brand new to New York. All those things you say are true.
Go ahead.
I remember Aaron not showing up. There being a lot of confusion. Was he sick? Did he have a breakdown? Kirsten taking over. God bless her. Who is a very successful talent manager now. Aaron's quote unquote protege. And I'm not being facetious. You know, he had a beautiful mind in terms of casting. I think he had found a young man who he thought he had talent, who had no stage experience, to play a role, perhaps. And this kid may or may not have some gang affiliation, but I don't know. It seemed very raw and risky, and he seemed like a tumultuous kid. And he would go above the stage, the second floor, and right before we were going to say our lines, he would shout them through the floor.
That's right.
To kill our delivery.
That's right.
And it and that was brilliant and awful at the same time.
Yeah. I won't say his name, but you know, it's absolutely right. Aaron lived above Nada in an apartment, and across the hall from him was a pretty problematic young man. He was a small guy, little, I remember, and red hair, and very problematic, had a long history of violence, I think probably some schizophrenia. And Aaron took this kid under his wing and wanted to really help him try to get through life. And that started really getting in the way of the production of Life's Lost is Loved. Aaron wouldn't show up for rehearsal. The kid would come storming onto the stage during rehearsal and say he was going to shoot everybody.
That's right.
He had a gun.
It would have been very different had this happened now, you know?
Yeah. It was just crazy Ludlow Street, you know, and Aaron, you know, promoted this idea of crazy Ludlow Street, and there was a lot of fun in that, but I know that, you know, I did Once Unwished Work at Nada. It was a big hit. I did Icarus and Arya at Nada. It was a big hit. And then I did Life's Lost is Loved. And the chaos of Ludlow Street and Nada just started getting in the way. And this is like a long, hard, heartful conversation for me to have. And I'm not sure I can get all into it. But, you know, and you're right, this kid somehow got a hold of the script and during performances would be shouting the lines down through the ceiling. And some of it was fun and wonderful, and some of it was just really fucking destructive.
Yeah.
And you know, Nada crashed and burned shortly thereafter. Wasn't necessarily Aaron's fault. You know, the rents, like, I think they tripled his rent overnight.
Yeah.
Shortly thereafter. And he ended up closing Nada. Aaron, Aaron has a long history. Everybody can talk about it, in terms of how he handled money and the space. It was an amazing space, amazing artists, amazing work, but it also had it had its challenges. And it was after Life's Lost His Love that I was like, you know, this guy, as much as he's done for me, and he was very instrumental in making Wants and Wished work in A Carcinaria and Life's Lost His Love, the great plays that they were for the time. And obviously directing them and dramaturging them and bringing lots of amazing actors to me and giving me a theater to work in. I mean, it was huge. But I couldn't continue. I couldn't continue with him because everything became just too unpredictable. I had a tough call to make. You know, do I stick with the unpredictability or do I try to get a little more professional so I can kind of continue to go? And that's where we move now, which is that some of the actors from Wants and Icarus and Life's from the Nada phase. You know, eventually some of us, we moved on and we did an Othello and a Griffin Hunter, which is, you know, that's historical record. But I'd like to hear from your perspective how that jumping ship and how that transition occurred. What were the conversations? How did that happen?
Sure. It's interesting and good to hear you talk about the disintegration of Nada at the time, because hearing you say it, I'm now reminded, I hadn't thought about it, and feeling the anxiety and uncertainty, like, oh, wow, I just made this new community, this our bohemian artistic haven, this beautiful playwright who I was falling in love with, and a brotherhood to you, and like, wait, what? That might shut down? And I remember there being anxiety about that happening, and in that environment of uncertainty, myself and an actor named Al Bendit just hung out, and I felt like he was my senior, but I didn't know by how much, but we just had a sense of each other, and I said, hey, do you want to hang out, have dinner, and read Othello? Just like, you know, casually Othello over spaghetti. And he said, sure, and we did that, and then that felt good.
So he read Iago, and you read Othello.
He read Iago, yeah. And you know, I was obscenely young and wrong for the part, now at 25. Bizarrely, I had played it in the Philippines. Totally inappropriate. But whatever. That motion was set forward. And I think there was this feeling of, hey, there is this little community of people that we have just met, but we're in our mid-20s and early 30s, and we don't want to let go of this thing, this intangible thing. So let's start reading this play in living rooms, and maybe something will happen. There was no, from the actor's point of view, there was no plan. It was just, let's stick together. So myself and my girlfriend at the time, Jessica, would like host little readings in our Lower East Side apartment, and we'd pack it in there, and we would read Othello a lot, and it seemed like, okay, there's a cast here, and hardly any of us had any producerial background. And I think we included you in those readings, and I don't know what you were thinking. Maybe you had a plan all along, but you were even acting in these readings. It was very intangible, and I don't know what happened other than a lovely man named Joshua Berg said, I would produce this production of yours with this group of people who came out of the Bromley machine.
And yeah, Josh Berg played Jimmy Jones Jr. in Icarus and Aria, and then he was Deepu.
And damn was he good.
I know. I went on to write the Tourette's play for him.
Syndrome.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. And so he offered to produce Othello. And I don't know how. I mean, I think you guys, and so you guys did Othello up at the, what's it called, the Culture Club or something like that?
The Culture Club up the Upper East Side. Yeah.
Culture Club? Are we sure that's what it's called? But yeah.
No, it was a posh little space with a hotshot director, Randolph Curtis Rand.
That's right, you guys. And I remember being very impressed. You had got Randy Rand. To me, that was like, wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow. And I don't know if it was like during Othello or after Othello or whatever, but I started, well, somewhere in there, I met Chad Gracia. I mean, I met Chad Gracia during Once Unwished Work, but he came and saw the play and then came every night and then obviously came to Icarus Scenaria and came to Life's Lost is Loved. And then when it was like, shit, I think Nada is crashing and burning and I don't know if I'm going to do my next play with Aaron, Chad and I said, well, let's start a theater company to keep these plays going. And so, and given, you know, some history with Chad and I and other in other areas that shall perhaps remain unspoken, we somehow dreamt up this idea of Griffin Hunter, the play. And so, but Griffin Hunter has very Othellic tones. It is in a sense, it's not as Othello as, say, Icarus Scenaria as Romeo and Juliet, or Life's Lost is Loved as Love's Labor is Lost, but it riffs on Othello in a way where I think I was starting to break free of Shakespeare a little more.
And
so it's not as mimicking or as in conversation, but I think it's important to point that you guys were doing Othello and I was writing Griffin Hunter. And they're related. And so we started preparing for the first Inverse Theater production, which was Griffin Hunter. And so Griffin Hunter was written because I'd always kind of worked with Aaron in terms of bringing in a script. And Aaron and I would sit there and read it. And then I'd go home and work on it some more. And this time I was like, well, I'm going to get some actors together. And we're going to read my drafts of Griffin Hunter. And do you have any memory of this stuff?
I do. That was very stressful. I had come from a background of a purist background where the actor's sole job was to honor, adhere, and release the sacred script, right? What was on the page.
Yep.
And we as humans don't matter. What our humanity matters, but our perspective doesn't matter because we're just here to make the script happen. And right. Suddenly we were doing these, let's call them workshops, at Chad Gracia's apartment.
Yes.
And I was flabbergasted.
I don't remember you seeming like you were having a very good time.
I was not. I did not understand what we were doing, why we were doing it.
Yeah.
I didn't understand why we would improv or talk about all these necessary and important things because I had come from a purist background at the time.
So yeah, well, you know, mentioning Al Bennett used to say, you walk in, Kirk walks in the room and hands these scripts to actors and then says, what should your character do next? and people were just like, what the hell? But yeah. So it was, and remember we'd be pounding on the floor and screaming and yelling, no, this has to happen. I mean, it wasn't play by committee. It wasn't like a group writing a play, but it was definitely like, I was writing the play, but I was really intrigued by getting actors to talk to me about what they wanted in the play, what they wanted to do as a character. And part of this is because at that time, my learning arc for being a playwright, I was very early in and I was coming out of years and years and years of being a poet, a writer, and I still felt I didn't understand plays, I didn't understand actors, I didn't understand what made a great play, and I wanted the actors to help me get in touch with desire and craving and objectives and what actors want to do in a role to make, because I knew then that if the play is something that actors want to do, then it will be done. So I was trying to access the actor intelligence and the actor energy through these workshops. And I know some people thought I was just completely off the rails, that what the hell was I doing asking Matt Mayer or Bill Kolias or Josh Spafford or Jenny Hannigan or any of these people what their character should do. And I remember you. Go ahead and talk about those meetings and your reaction to them.
I learned and changed a lot over that course of time, and it definitely helped release me as a storyteller, actor, and artist. Initially, I was offended. I'm like, why are you arguing to change this line? We're here to serve this line. And I saw Matt and Bill and these wonderful actors from a different school than I was having just opinions. Like, why it should be called?
It really strikes me as
fist.
That's right. It almost strikes me as like there isn't there kind of like an England America thing here? Maybe it's like you go to America and all the Americans are like shouting and screaming at the playwright, telling him what to write.
Exactly.
Whereas the older tradition is like you revere the playwright and you be quiet. So it was really like it's that democracy gone awry feeling you often get in America. So it must have been shocking.
It was totally shocking. And thank God I experienced it because it liberated me as a thinker and creative, but I was not happy or not comfortable in the beginning. But in time, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from these sort of raucous congresses, you know?
Yeah, right.
and in time, I got more emboldened to say, hey, well, here's 5 cents. You know, I remember going.
Yeah, right. Actually, maybe I do want to comment on what my character.
Maybe I do have something to say. And I think I was more inclined to the romantic or sentimental aspects. Like, hey, I like this name, Anne-Sophie. Did you know that Sophie in France, sometimes they put an "an" before it? Anne-Sophie, doesn't this sound pretty?
Right, right.
Or I met a girl named Mayumi. Hey, Kirk, listen to this name, Mayumi. Okay, so it wasn't. I wasn't dedicated to like changing your poetry or your meter or your structure, but I was like,
yeah,
here are some lyrical, beautiful things that I've seen them in my little life. Me and Jessica went to Asia right when you were creating it, and that was really fruitful because we went to Hong Kong.
Yeah,
right, we were in the midst of our young love, and we came back, and we had all these beautiful Mandarin phrases and different ideas and just a general inspiration, and we shared them with you, and it was really wonderful to see just flavor and spice trickle into the play. And and you're like, let's find images for Griffin. How do we make it more specific? And I said, hey, I lived in a boat for 12 years. And you're like, okay, let's build in a sailing theme.
That's all in there.
And I still see it to today, and I feel flattered, and it's beautiful. And so it just tells me you're interested in actors and specificity and poetry. I became more confident in collaborating with you then. And I was 27 at this point.
Yeah.
Who knows what at 27? Griffin Hunter.
So what was it like? What was it like doing that play? Tell us about the production.
Yeah. It was really hard. It was really, really, really hard. You're playing the title role on a riff on Othello in neoclassical theater, poetic realism, whatever you want to call it. And it's long. And you and one other guy are essentially the heartbeats of the play. And you're playing a morally challenge or ambiguous character, and you're 27 playing
a
UN diplomat.
You know what? playing 35-year-old, maybe. Yeah.
Sure,
yeah.
If you're being generous. And
yeah, yeah.
It was a lot of pressure. And in a role like that, they say, like, when you play Hamlet, you're really just playing... It's so massive and so truthful and so raw, you can only play aspects of yourself. And yeah. It's like that with Griffin Hunter or other quote-unquote sincere parts. You're not playing a character. Promelo's a character. Yeah. Mordecai's a character. You're playing a sensitive, thoughtful, mistaken human being. So the best I could do was bring my young self to it.
Yeah.
And we were creating a theater company. You were creating a style. We were forming a creative style. We were workshopping as we went along.
Yeah.
You were changing drafts as we went. And that's the first time I felt friction with you as a collaborator. I'm like, what the fuck? You're going to give me a new draft of two speeches 3 nights before opening? I'm used
to a 4-hour play.
I'm a 4-hour play, and you're pissed that I don't know in an opening night?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And
we were working with a director, Emma Griffin, that we kind of just like, I mean, I don't remember how we ended up hiring her. I mean, she had some history with Target Margin, and we didn't know. I don't think we knew her style.
We knew she had a style. She had a style. And, you know, like people like yourself and her and others, you know, she had some buzz, as they say now.
That's right. That's right.
But we didn't know her style. We just know she had a style.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it was the edge environment. What is the edge environment? When you all go somewhere where you're not fully comfortable or knowledgeable about what you're doing, but you do your best in collaboration to put something together. And I think we did.
Yeah.
And there are some people who saw that play as their first play with us, with you, as Romley, and go, that's the best play I ever saw from that time. And there's some people who walked out.
That's right.
There's some people who saw me in that play to this day going, you're Griffin Hunter. And there's some people going, oh my God, that was fucking tedious. You know, like, it depends who you are and where you were at the time. I love that play. Yeah. I love that experience. I love Soho Rep, another legendary space. And I love the work we made. It was really hard.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I think it is still a 4-hour play, and I think that was largely, in a sense, a product of the creative process. Because when I had me and 7-8 people in a room, and everybody wanted everything in the play, it was kind of like a lot of cooks in the kitchen, basically. And so you end up with a massive broth, and But, you know, as you know, I mean, this is kind of a tangent, but, you know, as you know, I finished that play a couple years ago. So, you know, we're talking 23 years after I wrote it. I finally would say, had the maturity and the skill and the insight to eventually round it out. And I think create what is... it's a great play now. I don't think it was a great play when it went up. It was a good play. It was an ambitious play, but it was not yet a great poetic masterpiece, which I'm going to say now it is. And that's only because, you know, the plot was hard to get. I had a hard time finding the plot, and the plot is complicated. And it took me a long time to get to the poetic level that I think the play deserved. You know, because the first version we did was very operatic. Emma directed it that way. It reminded me kind of like an avant-garde metropolitan opera piece. And in fact, Emma is now pretty much she's an opera director. I don't know I can't remember where, but she has moved to opera and she directs opera. Griffin Hunter was always pretty operatic. And we had a lot of the people that we would end up working with some more. We had Hank Wagner, we had Sarah Lipman, we had Al Bennett, we had Matt Mayer, we had Bill Collius, we had
Matt Daniels,
that's right. We had Robin Hussa, Jenny Hennigan, And, you know, and we, yeah. And so it was our first stab and it was, our first, you know, it was different than performing at NADA with Aaron. Cause like Aaron had like his scene, you know, and he knew the theater and we got to rehearse in this space and, it was on Ludlow Street and it was punk and fun and streety. And this, this was like, you know, we took a little sort of, I don't know. It was, we were being a little more professional. We were a little being a little more pro, and it was hard. It was hard. I don't know if it totally worked, but we did it. And you're right. It's people like Martin Denton. That was their first play, and they're just like that. That's when I got hooked on Bromley. But so yeah, we did it. Yeah,
which is to say, by the way, this is a formative moment in my life. Like this is the moment when we took the community and collaboration and your work out of an exclusively like downtown nightclub scenario and went off Broadway or off Broadway. And it was hard because it needed to be like, we need to wear our big boy pants and be seen by real people. And and see what we really were, you know, hear what other people thought about us. And that was great.
Yeah.
And that was great.
Yeah. And it, that's right. And it was, you know, it was like Chad's first, you know, it was the inverse, you know, with Chad raising money and hiring a director. And so it was an early version of what we came to do more of. So, so we did Griffin Hunter and that was our maiden voyage. And so what, do you remember what came next?
I think we did that. And I think we did Midnight Brainwash Revival next, right?
That is a good guess, but not quite right.
It's okay.
We did something that you were not in. And we can explain why, but we did American Revolution.
Was that next? Holy shit.
Yeah, because Emma directed Griffin Hunter, and then we were like, okay, let's do Emma again, and Emma directed American Revolution. But with American Revolution, Emma said, I don't want to just have to work with the inverse actors.
Yeah.
I want to cast it myself with other people that I know, which she did. So she did that.
And mind you, she did cast me. And
oh, really?
And, yeah, she casted me. And in my young, ambitious, probably egotistical little brain, I declined. Because I had workshopped the part of Benedict Arnold with you, meaning I read three or four novels that we had, and I got more confident brainstorming and around these ideas, and it felt like, oh, I'm going to play this role, Benedict Arnold, and she didn't cast me. And she cast me as the ensemble, including like the crazy king. Was it? Yeah.
King George. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, she didn't cast you as Arnold. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And I'd workshopped this part with you. And I thought, oh, well, this is the part I workshopped. And of course, looking back at it now, like, why would I expect anything? I should have no expectations. This is a theater. Be real. But at the time.
Yeah.
I was feeling my oats as like a downtown little guy, like, hey, I'm doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I wasn't feeling it at the time.
Well, and you were not alone. There was tension there because a lot of people were like, well, and you know, it was a tension that persisted through Inverse, I think. You know, it's like, what are we? Are we a bunch of actors? But we don't have a director. So we're bringing in directors, but those directors then have to work with our actors. And a lot of directors don't like to do that. Who's in charge? Who's the driving force here? Cause we're a theater company, based around a playwright, which is, you know, not specifically, you know, not really very much the norm. So that was it. And you were not alone in being like, why didn't I get cast in American Revolution as what I wanted? And I know that what it really was, you know, Chad and I, you know, I think that professionalization push involved, star fucking directors as much as we could, you know, like we wanted to work with directors that could get us somewhere.
Yeah.
And so we worked with Emma again on American Revolution, and she did a production that I think tested tested a lot of things.
So what do you mean by that? I mean, I wasn't a part of
So, Emma came from, I don't know where she, I think she went to NYU. She brought a lot of, she brought her husband, Mark Barton. She brought a set designer, costume designer. Well, no, I think she worked with Karen. But she brought expectations of professionalism with her, especially to American Revolution after the experience of Griffin Hunter. And expectations of professionalism means she wanted a certain level of budget. She didn't have the ethos of everybody pitches in. You know, it was like the director and the designers arrive and they show their plans and someone builds what they have devised and then they leave. And so administrationally for Inverse, we all of a sudden found ourselves needing to find like stagehands and people to break down the set and people to man the booth. And, you know, we'd always kind of been a little more everybody chipping in. And Emma brought a level of professionalism that I think challenged us because we didn't have as much money as NYU, but Emma was used to working with that kind of money. You know, and as you remember, that was Bobby Lopez's first gig.
Yep.
And so.
And it should be said, it was, whether you like it or not, it was a good, perhaps even great production. I saw it and it was engaging and intelligent and impactful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was very, yeah. It was very Target Margin. It was very Target Margin, which was what Emma had worked with Target Margin. It was a kind of a deconstructionist version of the play. And that also brought tension because I know that Chad was like, why are we deconstructing a brand new play? you know, like we deconstruct Shakespeare or Molière or Ibsen, you know, because we're struggling to find some blood in a desiccated corpse, but this is a new play. We should be doing it exactly. We should do, you know, but you know, whatever, that's all just like different people's opinions. But,
yeah.
So we did American Revolution. And then after that, we, you know, I don't think we felt like Emma was syncing with Inverse it was our vision of what kind of theater we should do. And it was then that I, through Al Bendit, received a referral for a friend of his who had seen all my plays from Once on Wishbrook onward, Howard Thorson. And we decided to – and Howard had been involved with Othello, so he was around. And apparently Howard had directed, and so we were like, well, let's give Howard a chance. And so we went on to do Midnight Brainwashed Revival.
Amazing.
With Howard.
Amazing.
So why don't you tell us about your experience with Midnight Brainwashed Revival?
Yeah, hearing you say that is amazing.
So somehow we got you, to come back.
Yeah. I don't know if it was then or before then. I started working with Target Margin around that time.
Yeah.
That's funny hearing you say that. So I don't remember how it was introduced, but I remember the first reading of your first draft of Brainwash, as we call it. And it was in a former school on the Lower East Side that had turned into event or art space.
Yeah.
And we had this reading, and it was the new play you had written. And immediately, I understood that this is Twelfth Night. Like, I get this. I know what this is. It's basically Twelfth Night. And I had no draft or copy. It was just given then and there. And in an actor's life, there are parts wherein you work for and labor over and study and explore, and there are parts that you just intuitively understand in your blood. And I'll never forget that first draft of the first reading of this part. And I knew in my bones and blood what this thing was, this part. and perhaps as a fault of mine, I've never swayed from what that part is or how I play because I felt it in my bones from day one until now. I still play the part.
And we're talking about the character of Mordecai.
Yeah. I don't know why you thought of me for this, how I ended up playing it, but I've been playing it for 25 years and it's as fresh and new and delicious as day one. And I'll never forget that reading because I thought, this is why I left the Philippines. This is why I left the safety structure of these Ingenue parts to explore a wildness in poetry or rock and roll in theater. It's like, I got it. I nailed it. This is my lane.
Yeah.
And yeah, man, it was a profound moment reading that play because I just felt like, oh, I'm home. This is my lane. This is the part. And it was so weird and bizarre and awful and cool. And if I can probably indulgently say, I thought like you'd written me a part that only I could do. And I've been playing it for half my life. And it was one of the best days of my life. Yeah,
that's great. That's rude. I don't remember how, I mean, I don't remember how you got Mordecai. I mean, I will say that the play was written through some reduced Griffin Hunter-esque workshops. So basically, me and Howard and Jen, my wife, and Chad would meet in our apartment on 13th and B and read the drafts and discuss the. The plot and hash it all out and figure it out, and they were kind of my little group of actors, but they were way more civilized. And you know, I think it was like Josh is playing Mordecai, like that's just obvious. There was an archness, there was a power, there was a sexiness, there was an insanity, a virulence, a masculinity, the hyper horse kind of energy we had loved in Primala. We'd loved it in Dada Mysterio. I'd seen you doing it in the workshops of American Revolution, playing Benedict Arnold, who, you know, not to do any what do they call it, where you give away the ending? What's that called? But you know, you do go on to play Arnold, as we'll discuss. You were just you were obviously Mordecai, and so. Tell us about that production, like the stage. Like what was doing that play like?
This to me, Midnight Brain Rush Revival, to me was the lane, the peak, the pure beauty of young inverse theater. Like this was it. This is the moment as we approached the year 2000. I think.
Yeah,
Y2K and all of the anxieties that went with it, which are still our anxieties now, right? They were just like put into words,
right? Right.
And we're all, a lot of the actors are my age; they're not quite 30, and we're all vital and ambitious, and it's turning the year 2000, and we've now made a theater company, and they're writing around actors. And we're back in the downtown theater at the Crane, and everyone's got buzz, and people are winning fucking Obies like Matt, and we're in good company, and it's sexy and weird, and it's not yet 9/11,
right? That's right.
People are horny and ambitious, and rock and roll, and goddamn, I wish it was the year 2000. And it was beautiful.
And as you say, your girlfriend at the time, Jessica Grace Wing, did some amazing music for it and sat on the stage with her friend Noah Masterson, who was also your friend, right? Did you
childhood
you that's right, you brought Noah Masterson to us, that's right?
I did. We were kindergarten besties. He's a lovely guy. And we restruck a friendship. So, we were all there together.
Yeah. And So we did Midnight Brainwash Revival in the month of December 1999, leading
along with
yes,
a co-production of Twelfth Night.
That's right.
Don't forget that.
We somehow couldn't stop being Aaron Bell and had to do like two plays at once. That's right. You guys did because I wasn't really involved. And I remember, we did Twelfth Night during the matinees because we had the theater. So we're like, we got the theater. Let's fill the space. So besides our Wednesday through Sunday night performances of Brainwash, you guys did two matinees of Twelfth Night. And that was really awesome because I did not go to a single rehearsal of that play. And I came and I saw the play and I absolutely loved it. So that was really exciting. It was very confirming to me to see the actors in our burgeoning company doing Twelfth Night so well and beautifully. And Brainwash was a drug play and there were probably drugs and fun and New Year's Eve. And it was pretty amazing. And you, as you say, it was the advent of Mordecai, who was certainly in a sense as big a presence as Primalo, just in a very different way.
Yeah. Mordecai and the play and that time, man, holds so much joy and innocence and glee in my heart because, it was before 9/11. It feels like a different time. It feels like the olden days. I feel like there was a before and an after, you know?
That's right.
And it was just fucking beautiful at the Crane Theater, which is still cooking and hopping. And I just discovered recently, by the way, I never knew foolishly that the Crane Theater stood for the Ukraine Theater. I never knew that.
That's right.
Did you know that? I didn't know that.
I've told this story already. I'm going to tell it quickly. So after my first play, which you weren't even there, I'm talking my first play in 1991, this guy, Bruce Hall, this British theatricalist, was like, "Kirk, what a beautiful play you made. Let's do more." So I translated a couple of plays from Karl Kraus and Paul Valery, and this is 92 or 93. But we didn't have a space, and Bruce was like, "Guess what? The wall has fallen. You know, the Berlin Wall has fallen. And the Ukrainian KGB is going out of business.
God.
And their headquarters on 4th Street between 2nd and 1st Avenues or in New York, 2nd and 3rd Avenues, is now empty. And the landlord has given me the right to turn it into a theater." So me and Bruce and my wife went to the Ukrainian KGB headquarters, and it was filled with busts of Lenin and propaganda posters. And it was the Ukrainian KGB headquarters. We spent a weekend putting it all into dumpsters and turning that into a theater. And my two translations were the first plays done there before it was ever the Crane. That's why it's called the Red Room. That's why it's the KGB bar. That's why it's called the Crane, because it was the Ukrainian KGB headquarters.
And it's
a great block. You know, La Mama's there and New York Theater Workshop is there. And the Crane, you're right, still lives on. And in a sense, the Crane is the son of Nada. Nada was the first kind of, not the first. Some people would say Cafe Chino was the first. But, you know, Nada was a thriving space in the 90s on Lower East Side where anybody could do anything. There were three shows a night. And the Crane kind of took that little mantle and continues to this day.
Amazing. I did not know that you worked there previously. That's amazing. Holy cow, man. I remember those lines out the door to see our late night shows that timed with midnight. Oh my God. So beautiful.
It was night after night of just a lot of fun and
I also designed the set.
You did, that's right.
And it was the beginning
you and Chad.
It was the beginning of my directing career for you, even though I'd done it.
That's right.
In my youth.
That's right.
And I was in Chad's apartment.
That's right.
We made a paper mache mountain in his living room.
That's right.
Like
That's right.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was That's so right. massive right. and obscene and stupid.
Yeah.
That we right. couldn't get it out the door without cutting it in parts.
That's awesome.
Oh my
That's
God.
Awesome. Yeah. That's prototypical of that time. Like, you're just filled with energy and you build something so big you can't get it out the door. Exactly. Huge party, huge New Year's Eve party, I remember. There was a feeling there that we, you know, a lot of people were coming to our plays and we were having a lot of fun We found Jane Stein and Jeff Nash at that. They came and saw that play and became our designers. And Howard took up the directing. And
in my own career, a lot of people saw that play. I got a lot of parts and roles with other companies after that. Like that was a buzzy little play. And
that's right.
Man, Reed Farrington's. Sarah Farrington, I think they were involved, or Matt Mayer.
They came one play later, but yes, that's right. I think Reed saw the play.
I think he did lights. Let's check on that. I think he did lights because I remember him pulling me aside, going, "I'm going to bathe you in red light like blood."
Maybe he did. Yeah, maybe he did.
I think he did.
Yeah, yeah.
I have so many memories of that, man. Like Matt, I mean, iconic, famous, acclimated Matt, pulling me aside going, "What if we take our curtain call and we're both munching on scenery, like literally?" Like, let's eat this set. I'm like, okay.
Chewing the set. Yeah. Chewing the scenery, literally.
And
that's how I would describe Mordecai's performance, by the way. Was
yes,
literally
definitely, till this day.
Eating the scenery.
And that liberation and that unbridled rock and roll-ism definitely affected me as a young downtown creative actor-director. Like, I was seduced by that. Like, that got in my veins, you know?
Yep.
And that was great. Yep. And also tempting and dangerous. But I would have people going to me going, "Wait, are you Mordecai? When are you Mordecai?" Like, it's the classic problem of, do you become the role? It was a wonderful thing to happen. So, yeah, Midnight is still as potent and sexy and dangerous and ridiculous as it was then until now.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I think you know, I'm you and I are going to have to do another podcast.
Yeah.
I think
we'll do part 2.
We have about 15 minutes, but I think instead of moving on to like the next thing, which would be American Revolution, let's talk a little more about Brainwash, cuz you, as you say, you've been doing it multiple times. Tell us some of the other times you did it and the circumstances. You always played Mordecai, so tell us about other Brainwash manifestations.
Yeah, I probably can't itemize each production now because there are many, but along this trajectory, I also picked up the directorship of it in a actor manager type format.
Because Chad and I kind of had the idea that, like, you know, wow, we could do this play every New Year's Eve, you know?
Yeah,
like
we did that like for a few years. We did.
A la 12th Night, right? Wasn't 12th Night kind of done,
exactly. Some, yeah.
Right?
A holiday play. So we would do in December. We did it at CSV, Clemente Solos Vela Center. We did it at the
Theatorium.
Theatorium, which was an awesome space,
where
many great American independent plays came out of. We did it
in
upstate New York. We did it at Theater Row.
That's right.
Yeah, we did.
That's right.
We did it. Yep. We did it in the Catskills, where where
the Borscht Belt.
Oh my gosh, where one very posh couple were so offended by my line, Velveeta vagina, that they walked out, and I thought, I've made it. I'm a punk American artist, and they walked out. So we did it for
Velveeta vagina, just pushed them over the edge. Yeah, that's it.
That was too much. So that was a glorious time.
Do you remember we did a reading of it at one of our retreats?
Okay.
In this little like pagoda in the grass, and a woman. So we kind of like put out like some kind. Remember, we were way up in the mountains of upstate New York at one of our company retreats, which I don't think we should talk about those and what went down there. But we were like, well, let's do a reading of Brainwash. And I think Hank arranged to put some kind of notice in the local papers.
And people
come
showed
here
up.
A reading. Well, I, from my memory, a woman and like her 8-year-old son showed up, and we sat there and read Brainwash into their face.
Oh,
and I just remember
God.
Sitting there going, oh my God, did nobody mention that this is like an X-rated play? God damn. And I remember that woman just trying to put on a happy face as her son was being like, you know, slapped with a Velveeta vagina.
Oh my God, I do remember that. Oh my God. That's amazing.
So
I hope he's a very accomplished and well-rounded young man right now.
Yeah, no thanks to us. Yeah, so you're right. We did Brainwash all over the place, and like the holiday play, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun,
and
many actors in different roles.
Yeah, deserves to live on, and it brings so much joy and laughter and melancholy to anyone who hears or sees it, and maybe we do it some more. You know, it's
yeah,
it is
and
a
we
holiday
did it.
Play.
We recorded it recently as part of the Cancer Tour 2019. It still sits in the can, and it will be released. The world will get to hear Josh Baffert playing Mordecai someday. Yeah, you're right. It lives on. You know, I had the pleasure of seeing that play performed in San Francisco. So it was, you know, it was Fool's Fury Theater, Ben Yalom, who went on to direct Bangers Flopera. And, I haven't had a lot of plays done by other people. One of them, American Revolution, you and I drove to Cleveland. Remember that?
I do remember. Yeah.
So I flew to San Francisco and saw Fool's Fury, do Midnight Brainwash, and that was Jason Craig and Jessica Jelliff as Jason Craig played Hooch, and Jessica Jelliff played, I believe she played Spam or Trash. And my mom came, and my mom's wife Jane, I think Chad came out, and a lot of people came out. I think Bill Coleus went out. Chad rented a red Mustang, and we drove around San Francisco. We just thought we were superstars, and
yeah.
it was the funniest play I'd ever seen. Now, I will say, you know, it was always exciting to go. Like I remember the American Revolution in Cleveland just being like, wow, you know, like because I wasn't a part of the productions, and I didn't watch rehearsals night after night after night. And there's often a thing where it's like, you know, if you're that involved and opening night comes, you're not able to really enjoy it because you're still worried about the fact that, you know, somebody's not hitting their blocking, or nobody has the lines, or the lights fell down, or you know what I mean? Like it's just, but being able to fly to San Francisco and see that play, we were literally on the floor. It was so funny. And if that's the experience that other people had watching Brainwash, then that play is insanely good. And so, yeah, so that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, well, you know, I think I don't want to move on to American Revolution because that's a whole new tale of many productions.
Let's take a pause here.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
I think we should. Yeah. So thank you for remembering and being so intelligent and obviously these plays and that experience got into you and you got into them. And I had Hank on last week and he was just he casually dropped, at that time this guy Josh Spafford entered the picture and he had such a immediate, intuitive, intelligent grasp of the language and how to deliver these plays. And I will say, for instance, the auditions for Icarus and Arion, Once I Wished Work, there was always this person who came into into the audition room, and we called them Yaleys. And I don't know if they necessarily went to Yale, but they were Yaleys, and they were actors who were very crisp, very, they enunciated, they had histrionics, they had modulation to their voice, they understood what they were saying, they were quick to grasp and express this new verse, which often wasn't easy to parse, they could parse the language, but yet they were always just kind of stiff and kind of too clean, crispy, and I think what was great about you was you had all the chops that these Yaleys had, but you just were not a Yaley. You were like a wild animal. And so that energy and that kind of actor, like, you became the prototype for what I was looking for in actors. They needed to have the skills to do the language, but having the skill to do the language wasn't enough. They had to get that theater is a huge, intense, physical, wild, religious party where you've got to drag the audience into the play just through pure charisma and that there's got to be an element of danger and wonder. Yeah. Or people are just going to get bored. It's going to be too stiff. So you really became the epitome of that for me. Way to go. Yeah, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon, Josh. Thank you, man.
Beautiful, man.
Take care. All right, so I'm going to close the show with a song called Tend Well the Daughters. And the reason I chose this tune is that it is, I believe, the only song on any of the Goodhart albums that was written by someone other than me. It was written by Jessica Grace Wing for our play, The Death of Don Flagrante Delicto. The version that was done during the play is completely different than the one I did for the album because it was sung by actors on stage. But I loved the tune so much that I decided to do a version of my own. In doing it, I did try to hold to the kind of original spirit of the piece. It's kind of a porch song. It's got sort of some Virginia Mountains kind of feel, all derived from the play The Death of Don Flagrante Delicto. The reason I chose it, and the connection to Jessica Grace Wing is that I met Jessica Grace Wing through Josh Spafford. He introduced me to her. They were dating at the time, and he knew that we needed a composer. And he was dating Jessica, and he introduced us. And that resulted in Jessica and I working on quite a few plays, including the musical Lost. So Josh brought Jessica into my life. And so here it is, my version of Tend Well the Daughters by Jessica Grace Wing from The Death of Don Flagrante Delicto off the second album by the Goodhart, Smell the Sun. Let them wander freely of what's dear.
This has been the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirkwood Bromley. For more information, visit inversetheater.org.